SMA News Today, daily digital coverage of spinal muscular atrophy.
Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast, episode 18. I am your host, Kevin Schaefer. Joining me today is my own coworker, Michael Morale, who is the forums director for BioNews Services. We're going to be doing things a little bit differently today. Instead of me interviewing someone else from just a different person from the SMA community, we are going to, Michael and I are going to be talking about our own lives and sort of interviewing each other, doing a kind of roundtable discussion about our daily lives, our work with BioNews. So Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, you bet, Kevin. That way we can both talk to each other and we can interview each other. I think it'll be an interesting episode.
Exactly. I'm really excited about this one. And for our listeners out there, you can, if you just follow the podcast, we have a ton of other content up for SMA News Today. Michael does a lot of videos for us, and he also does other podcasts, and he has his own personal YouTube channel, which you can find at SMA Journey 51. So please check those out, and we'll definitely be talking about all that today and just having kind of a general discussion about what we do in our lives. So, Michael, to get started, so you and I, you know, come from different generations of living with SMA. So I'm really curious to hear, I mean, and some of, granted, some of the story I know from getting to know you, but for our listeners out there, can you just talk a little bit about your background, what it was like for you growing up with SMA, especially when accommodations weren't nearly what they are today?
Right. Yeah. Accommodations have definitely changed. I know that, you know, my parents knew that there was something wrong whenever I was young. And the first diagnosis was muscular dystrophy. And the doctor said, take him home, enjoy what time he's got left. And oh, by the way, go ahead and start planning his funeral. So, you know, we knew that my parents knew that there was something wrong. But later, when I started getting a little stronger, they just really had no explanation. They knew it was a neuromuscular disease. And, but it wasn't really until they isolated the gene for SMA. So I didn't really learn my diagnosis till 1996. So they told me myotonia congenita was my diagnosis, which is kind of like a dumping pot when doctors really didn't know what to say or didn't know what it was. Myotonia congenita is a neuromuscular disease similar to SMA. But anyway, growing up, things were, you know, quite normal. My father was a, you know, a big guy, you know, real strong type of guy. And so he could easily get me up steps and everything like that. And it wasn't really until I went into junior high, which was my first experience with the public school system. And that's when the school system really had not implemented ramps. So for me to get into the school, the principal or somebody would have to pop a wheelie and get me up three or four steps. So we tried working with the school system. They didn't want to do it. So we actually filed a lawsuit against the Dallas Independent School District. And right before we were ready to walk into the courtroom, they settled out of court and decided that they would build ramps in all the schools. So it was at that point that we started seeing more public places, more, you know, schools, restaurants, starting to really get into the habit of building ramps so that those of us that were in wheelchairs would have access to it. So, it, you know, I grew up in an era where the Americans with Disabilities Act was really implemented, and that's when you saw a lot of companies being forced to make these changes.
Right, right. Well, and it's fascinating, too, that so you said that it wasn't until 96 that you got your official diagnosis?
Correct.
See, that's just fascinating because to put it into perspective, I was born in 93, diagnosed in 95. So you were diagnosed even after I was.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, see, you were probably diagnosed before me because your doctor, you had probably seen your doctor quite a bit. They actually called me, a hospital by the name of Zell Lipschy, which is now part of the UT Southwestern Medical Group. But they called me, and they actually called me at work, and they said that we have your medical records from when you were born, and you know, we think that you've got SMA. So would you be willing to come in for a blood test? And I did, and the blood test came back positive for SMA type 3.
That's interesting. And you, but you started using a, was it a power chair early on, or what, did you use a manual chair first?
No, I was in a manual chair up until junior, or actually up until high school. During the summer break between junior high and my first day of high school is when my parents bought me my first electric wheelchair. So I had the summer to get used to it, to, you know, scratch up all the walls and doors in my house and, you know, try to run over the family before I ran over any teachers.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I mean, when I first got my first power chair, it was a similar kind of thing. I mean, I got it when I was little, but probably about maybe 3 or so. But I was only allowed to drive it outside at first. I couldn't take it indoors until I got used to it. And then eventually, you know, I was let in. But granted, I still chase kids around the playground at preschool and all that with it. So, and ran people over. So, you know, it was, yeah, it's always, you know, that's the risk you take when you give, you know, a kid who's quite hyper a power wheelchair.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I know that whenever we were at the conference, the Acura SMA conference that was out here in Dallas this year, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in a moment, but that was the first time that I had ever seen little children in electric wheelchairs. You know, that, I mean, I was shocked. I was seeing 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds going around, you know, chasing each other, playing what I thought was a very unique game of tag. But, you know, they're sitting in their $30,000 wheelchairs. And I'm thinking to myself, God, I wish I would have had that when I was 3 years old. It would have been nice.
Right, right. Yeah, no, it's crazy how things have changed. But, and I know, you know, different parents have different views on that when they let their kids start out in a power chair. But you, so you felt pretty comfortable just using that. I mean, I know you're type 3, so I have a little more upper body strength, probably especially when you were younger. But you were okay using the manual chair for that many years?
Oh, I was fine with it. I mean, really, it was the only thing that I knew because electric chairs weren't around. You know, I mean, the first electric wheelchairs came about in the 70s, or at least the ones that I knew about. So, yeah, but, you know, to me, a manual wheelchair was just normal everyday life. I was stronger, of course, whenever I was younger. So I was able to roll myself and get from room to room, or, you know, if I was in school, I could, you know, I could roll myself or somebody would help me. But yeah, it wasn't until probably the late 70s whenever I started seeing the electric wheelchairs hit the market.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah, no, it's, I'm always interested to see what that was like. And, I'm just curious, you know, with your school life and all that. So you mentioned the thing about the ramps, but were there other issues you encountered in terms of, because I just think about, for me, you know, I had an aide with me all from elementary school up. In college, I just had to have, I had note takers in class that the disability services office provided me with. But aside from that, I was, you know, on my own. I had to, you know, rely on friends or whatever to help me around. But from elementary school to high school, I always had a personal aide with me. Did you ever feel like you needed that kind of assistance, or were you pretty good just getting around on your own, getting, you know, books out and that kind of thing?
You know, to be honest with you, Kevin, I don't even remember the option of having back then. Back then, they didn't have note takers. They didn't have caregivers that would stay with you during the day. I mean, usually my instructors, like in grade school and junior high, they would let me leave class 5 minutes early to get to my next class without having to, you know, fight through my way, you know, through the hallways. But I also walked on braces and crutches too.
Okay, gotcha.
So I wasn't always in a wheelchair. I walked on braces and crutches till I was in junior high. Then I finally gave up trying to walk because I knew that whenever I got into high school, my classes were going to be, you know, instead of 5 rooms apart, it's going to be 2 buildings apart. So I knew that I was going to have to be in a wheelchair at that time.
I gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah, no. And I was going to ask that too, like how long you were ambulatory and all that.
Right.
But yeah, that's interesting. And I don't think we mentioned, I mean, I know, but could you state where you're from? Because I think I forgot to mention that at the beginning of the episode.
I was born and raised in Dallas, Texas, and I now live in Irving, Texas.
Okay, gotcha. Which is about like half hour away or a little less?
Oh, well, we're still in Dallas County. It's just just a little town just on the edge of Dallas, between Dallas and Fort Worth.
Gotcha.
So it's, it's a small area. I moved out here because I used to work for ExxonMobil, and I wanted to be close to their corporate headquarters because I was in charge of their safety and their ergonomics for the Dallas region. So I had to go to the corporate headquarters, and I got tired of driving an hour in the morning to get to work and an hour and a half to get home. So we ended up building a house. And now, you know, at that time, after we moved in, I was less than probably 3 minutes away from work.
Okay, gotcha. That's really cool. And before we kind of, we're going to flip the switch in a minute and kind of, I'm going to let you ask me some questions. But one more thing I wanted to ask first was, so you had your parents and you have a brother too, correct?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so, and is he older or younger than you?
He is 5 years older.
Okay, gotcha. So I was just kind of curious about your family life growing up. You know, I also have older siblings, so I was just curious what that was kind of like for you. Did your brother kind of help out sort of as a caregiver as well, or what was that dynamic like?
No, he never really had to. My parents were always there. You know, me and my brother had the typical brother relationship, you know. Mm-hmm. He could beat up on me, but, you know, God forbid anybody else touch me. So, you know, we had a love-hate relationship where we just loved to hate each other every once in a while. But, you know, it was a typical normal family, you might say, because he did his thing and I did mine.
Sure. Absolutely.
You know, we didn't really hang out a lot because even at 5 years apart, his friends, you know, wanted to do their thing. And, you know, they didn't want, you know, the little brother hanging around. And, you know, I don't blame him. I guess I would have been that way if I was the older brother. But, you know, we got along just like brothers always get along.
Sure. That's good. Well, on that note, yeah, I wanted to give you an opportunity to ask me some questions. Then we'll kind of go back and forth.
We've got
plenty of other topics to discuss. But, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I met you, Kevin, whenever you called me and asked me to do some work for BioNews Services. And I actually got to meet you face to face when we went to the SMA conference that was held here in Dallas. And one of the fascinating things was you had a Janko robotic arm that was attached to your wheelchair. How did you learn about that? Because, you know, I don't think there's a lot of people that really know, you know, much about that and really what a benefit it could be for you.
No, that's a great question. So this takes me back to about 3 years ago or so. Well, even before that. So I write about this a lot in my column. Sort of my story is that, so I was born with type 2, diagnosed in 95. And for kind of like what you were saying, I grew up pretty normal, you know, like when you have SMA and when you're born with it, you know, people assume that, oh, it must be so tough and all that. But really, for a long time, it was just my normal, you know. I mean, yes, I was in a wheelchair, but for the most part, you know, that was the main limitation. I still had a decent amount of arm strength and that kind of thing. And, you know, I went to school, I had friends, of course, and was very active socially. And I always say I hit all the normal milestones, was a moody teenager, all of that. But it was about my sophomore year of high school was when the degenerative aspect of SMA started to really close in on me. And so I remember it was around that time I just really struggled to lift my arm, especially when I was trying to eat dinner or even lift a sandwich at lunch or whatever. And that became extremely frustrating for me. And so and that was really, again, the first time that SMA really weighed down on me. Because, of course, I had, you know, hospitalizations when I was younger and all that, but those were always temporary. This was when it hit me that, you know, this was going to be, I was losing abilities that I once had. And that was really frustrating for me. And so for a while, we used a type of arm support, which was not electrical or anything. It was basically just like a stand that I could put my arm on. And I used that for several years, and that helped me enough for the time being. Because it allowed me to kind of, it was just sort of like a prop for my arm, that I could use, and it made it easier to lift a fork or whatever. But it still wasn't enough to, do anything, you know, permanent to solve this issue of like, because by the time I was in college, I was really relying on friends and family almost 100% to help me eat and drink. I never had any problems chewing or swallowing, but I just could not lift really anything anymore. And so my parents and I looked into different devices, and we tried different things. Nothing really worked because we didn't find anything electrical that could just, you know, do the work for me. That a lot of times it was just, you know, things that you still had to have a good amount of physical strength in order to operate, which wouldn't have been conducive to me. So then it was in 2015, I think it was my mom came across this online somewhere about the Jayco arm, and it's from a company called Canova Robotics, which they're based in Canada. And, you know, we saw it and it looked great. I tried not to get my hopes up too high just because, you know, we had hit so many road bumps up until that point. And so, anyway, we found out about the company. We scheduled a meeting with one of the technicians there, because basically how Canova works is they're based in Canada, but they have technicians in the United States who go around and install arms, repair them, and also they bring prototypes for people to try out. And so that's what we did. We met with the technician, and he allowed me to use a prototype. And it was cool because the day I went to go test out my a prototype to see if it would work for me or not, there was another kid in my area. He was about, I think, like 17 at the time. He was coming out with one, with his own arm. And, you know, my local news stations did a story on him. And so I got to talk with him for a few minutes before and see how it worked. And he was just like, yeah, man, it's awesome. And so I tried it out that day. Absolutely loved it. It worked. It was really an answered prayer because not only was it electrical, but it's fully controlled by the joystick on my chair. And so you can see pictures of it and stuff in my columns. And also one of our other columnists, Ryan Berhar, he got one recently as well. And he's been making some videos about it and posting those on the forums, which you can check out. But yeah, it was. And so we did. So once we met with the technician and I tested the prototype and loved it, at the time, insurance was not covering them because it was such a novelty item. There were only like 20 in the U.S. at the time. And it's a $50,000 arm. You know, I'm not going to lie. We, you know, knew that it would be life changing and we wanted to have it. So we just set up a GoFundMe the next day. And within, I think, about 24 hours, we had already raised over $1,000, and it just kept going from there. So we raised the money in about 6 months' time. The company actually ended up paying for the last part of it. But we raised well over $40,000 on our own. And we got, you know, multiple businesses involved. My dad's a UPS driver, and so he had a lot of contacts there that were more than willing to donate, and businesses that did fundraisers. And then my mom, you know, did a lot of online connections and that kind of thing. And I got it in December of 2015. And, oh, it's been beyond life-changing ever since then, because not only did it allow me to kind of do things that I used to be able to do and couldn't for a long time, but it also allowed me to do things that I'd never been able to do before. So, right. Picking stuff up, and I do have a service dog, which is great, but she's more of a companion. I can talk about that a little bit later, but she's more kind of a companion dog at this point. And for me, the arm just fulfills a lot of practical needs for me. So it's been just a phenomenal, really life-changing tool ever since then. And so I had it for my last year of college, and I've had it ever since then. And
Well, you know, I noticed that it was attached to your chair. So, of course, right. Where you go, it goes. But let's say that if somebody wanted to buy one of those arms, could they attach it to a table or to a desk instead of their chair? Or is it specifically designed to be attached to the wheelchair itself?
So it's specifically designed for the chair, because how it works is it's mounted to the side of a wheelchair and it's all connected to the same. They set it up so that it's connected to the same technology as your chair. So for instance, I take it off every night and put it back in its case, and then I charge my chair, and that's how it gets power. So it's connected to the same power source as my chair. So all the technology is interlinked there. So it can't, that, yeah, so it can only be attached to the wheelchair, nothing else. I mean, right. I don't know much about other products that Canova makes, if there is something like that. But as far as I know, this is the main thing. And yeah, it's just for wheelchairs.
Okay. Yeah, because I think your arm is attached at the front of your chair.
It's like the front, kind of on the left side. Yeah.
Right. That it wouldn't work for me because I have to get up underneath the desk. But if they could maybe connect it to the back of the chair, it would be, you know, an option that somebody could actually look at as well. Because it should be attached on your chair. There should be like a railing on your chair. Is that what it's attached to?
Yeah, so they can, I think they can put it kind of in different places. And Canova is really good about working with each individual and making sure it's customized how you want it, you know. For me, it worked out perfectly to where it is because I keep my tray on all the time, which I know a lot of people that's made don't. They don't use their trays for their wheelchairs. For me, my tray is my desk, so I love it. Granted, sometimes it can feel a little restricting because I always have something right in front of me, you know, and sometimes I like to have it off me just to have a little more, you know, air and that kind of thing. But for me, you know, my tray is like my desk, and the arm coincides with it perfectly, so it's not an issue for me. But I get what you're saying. But Canova technicians are really good about working with each individual, and again, the nice thing is that even if you just want to test out a prototype and see how it works for you, you can do that without having to commit or anything, you know?
Yeah. It's definitely something that I'm thinking about as well, because I've lost the ability to feed myself as far as lifting the food up to my mouth. I mean, I can still, you know, chew my food and swallow. I don't have any trouble with that, but getting the food up to my mouth is sometimes a little bit of a challenge. And even though I'm going through physical therapy, and we can talk about that in a minute as well, but even though I'm going through physical therapy, you know, my core strength's improving, but my arms are not improving as much as what I would have thought they would. But, you know, who knows? It's a work in progress. So it is something that I'm actually looking into now.
Yeah, no, and I'm happy to answer any questions for you or anyone else there. And, you know, for our listeners, like I said, you join the SMA forums. I discuss that a lot on there, Ryan and I both. So we'd be happy to answer any questions about it.
Right. Okay, good deal. Yeah, I know that, you know, the nice thing about the SMA forum is that it really allows those of us with SMA and even caregivers. I mean, you don't have to have SMA to join the SMA forum. And so that's the nice thing about it. You can ask questions. You can get a lot of questions answered, too, that I don't think you could get answered anywhere else.
Right. Well, and that brings me to a point about, you know, I wanted to talk about the conference because... So for me, you know, when I was, like I said, when I was younger and SMA didn't bother me as much and I was just trying to live a normal life, you know, and I talk, this is, you know, really the basis of my column, Embracing My Inner Alien, because it talks about how I went from, you know, so desperately wanting to just be normal to embracing my abnormalities. And so when I was younger, I really wasn't interested in hanging out with other people with SMA and other disabilities, especially in like my middle and high school years, because I was afraid of like, you know, it just falling into stereotypes. And I just didn't really have any interest in it. I just wanted to be a normal kid like everyone else in my school. And that was it. And so, you know, my family and I went to the Cure SMA conference. At the time, it was called Families of SMA. They changed the name of the organization in... I forget what year exactly, but it's somewhere in the last decade. But anyway, we went to those conferences pretty regularly for when I was in like elementary school. And then we stopped going for a while just because, again, I didn't really have much interest. And then with the culmination of me losing arm strength and thinking about college, all these things, I realized that, you know, I really did need to connect with other people in the SMA community to learn from them and to ask questions. And just because, you know, they understand things you're going through that other people just don't. So, and as a result, you know, I've been back going to regular conferences for the last, you know, 5-6 years. But this was your first conference this year. So I was just curious to ask about A, what that was like for you, and B, was this the first time you really connected with a large group of SMA people, or did you have anyone else from the SMA community you knew growing up?
Okay. What was it like for me? I would say, now see, I was only there for 2 days. I was there for Friday and Saturday, but those 2 days were probably the most important 2 days of my life because I got to see just how many people had SMA. To be honest with you, I had never really met too many people that had SMA. I only knew one other kid. And when we moved into our new house back in 2000, this guy that owns a restaurant up here next to our shopping center, his son had SMA. And that's the first, that's the first person I'd ever met who had SMA. So to see so many people with SMA, and what made me angry, though, was that this is considered an orphan disease. You know, you have all these people that have SMA. It's the number one genetic killer of children, and it's classified as an orphan disease. It just blows my mind. But to see all these people out there, it was eye-opening and awe-inspiring because, you know, I've always said that if you give me 10 minutes, I'll find you 10 people that are worse off than me. And it really hit me, you know, that I'm not as bad as what I thought, but seeing all these little children with SMA, they had smiles on their faces. They had no worries in life. They only cared about playing with the other children. And it was just, like I said, it was eye-opening.
Right, right. Well, and it brings up a good point, too, because, you know, when I try to explain SMA to other people, it's such a broad spectrum because, you know, not only the different types, but it just affects everyone differently, physically, mentally, emotionally. And like you said, you know, there are people who are much weaker than us, who are stronger than us. It just, it really varies in terms of its effect, its how quickly it progresses with some people and how stagnant it remains for others. So, and that's why I think, you know, it's just really important to connect with other, if you have SMA or if you're part of the community, to connect with other people in the community for that reason, because, you know, it just helps us learn from each other, you know?
Well, I think SMA is getting to be a topic that more and more people are talking about. A lot of that has to do with now that there is an FDA-approved treatment that we've all been on, or most of us have been on now for a while. And then we've got another one that's getting FDA approval, hopefully sometime within next year, the first 6 months. So I think we're seeing a change that we never thought would happen up until maybe 2 years ago. There was really no hope, you know. And so with Biogen's Spinraza, and now with the other pharmaceutical companies that are getting clinical trials underway and getting some good results, there's a lot more hope for those of us with SMA now that I think it's just fueling our excitement because, you know, hey, Spinraza has done wonders for me. It's leveled me off to where I'm not getting any worse. I'm getting a little bit stronger. So it's bought me more time. And with that time comes hope. And I think those of us with SMA see that, and I think the community at large is also seeing that as well.
Oh, absolutely, and that's actually a really good transition there, because of course I did want to talk about Spinraza and just each of our journeys. So, did you want to start there and just talk about? I'm curious about. I mean, obviously it's had a good effect on you, but just the specifics of when you heard about it, and then when you started applying for it and how long that process took. Sure. I'm really curious about your journey there.
Well, you know, it's kind of a funny story how I found out about it. I had another YouTube channel where I just talked about recent topics in the news. And I was doing a story about pharmaceutical companies and how they're, a lot of pharmaceutical companies have bad names, you know, because people know that they raise the prices, that most of these companies are only in it for the bottom line. And so I was doing a story about Martin Scorsese and how he raised the price. He purchased he created a pharmaceutical company and bought another pharmaceutical company, and he had raised the price on a drug that AIDS patients needed. And so he was always in trouble. You know, he had to go before the Senate and the House to talk about why he was doing this. So I was doing a story about that when a little ad popped up that talked about Biogen and their first treatment for SMA. And so I was like, what do you mean a treatment for SMA? So I called my neurologist, and my neurologist said, Michael, I was going to call you next week to talk to you about this. They were like in a buzz because it had just hit the market. And so that's how I found out about Spinraza. So I started probably in January of 2017, getting interested in it, finding out what needed to be done. I went to see my neurologist again. We did the paperwork on it, and she sent it in to Biogen. And then Biogen called me and told me that they were going to assign a FAM, or a family access manager. And so the family access manager contacted me, and we started the process. So it took a lot longer than what I think we wanted, because the hospital that I was going to use, which was UT Southwestern Medical Center, they were going through the steps of getting approved to be an injection site. And it just seemed like it was, you know, one little delay after the other. Well, they just got ready to start when I got an email that said, we're putting a halt on our steps right now for the actual treatment because we're not ready yet. And I think what happened was, you know, you get the legal department involved. The hospital had to jump through a lot of, you know, red tapes and hula hoops to get, you know, everything organized before they got started. So I went with another doctor and another hospital, and they were having the same problems. So I just stayed with UT Southwestern. And then I think about 3 weeks later, I got an email that said, we're back on track and we're ready to go. Call us. So I called and went in again, set up an appointment, and I began my injections in September of last year.
Okay, great. That's, yeah. And yeah, that was about just a few months before I started. So, but yeah, I was curious too about, you know, how long that took and everything. And what are some of the biggest improvements you've seen, or just, or even, you know, seemingly small but significant changes?
Yeah, I think a lot of us, we're measuring our changes in little changes. We see little changes as big changes because, you know, I started noticing a difference probably right after my second loading dose. My arms felt a little bit better. I felt a little bit better. It was after my second loading dose that I called my neurologist and said, hey, look, now that my body's getting the protein that it needs, can I do physical therapy? Because, you know, we were not allowed to do physical therapy because people with neuromuscular diseases, you stress the muscles, you can actually make yourself weaker. And I didn't know that as a child growing up, and I exercised all the time. So if I hadn't have done all the physical therapy and work that I did as a child, I may be stronger now. I don't know. But she told me, she said, absolutely, find you a good physical therapist and I'll write the prescription. So I found a real good physical therapist here in Irving, and I've been seeing her now for just a little over a year. And some of the changes that I've seen, of course, my arms are a little bit stronger, but we do more work on my core strength, my abdominals, my back, my shoulder, my neck. And just recently, she's transferring me out of my wheelchair onto a therapy table so that we can work the quadriceps, the hamstrings, the calf muscles. We're doing flexation exercises in my feet and my toes. So, but I think overall changes, big changes that I've seen definitely have been my breathing. I feel better. My voice is stronger. I'm able to talk for a much longer period of time without getting winded. So those are the major changes that I've seen.
Yeah, I would say those are similar to mine in a way. I mean, the voice thing is a big thing for me that my family and friends have noticed, just because I've always had a pretty booming voice, but they said just I can talk, like you said, I can talk for longer periods of time without, you know, running out of breath and that kind of thing. But yeah, on that note, so I'll go ahead and share my story too. So it's funny, the week that Spinraza was improved, so a week before I graduated college, I went to North Carolina State University, and then it was approved on that Friday, and it was the same day my sister went into labor with her and her husband's first child, who was born the next day, which was Christmas Eve. And wow. Then, and I was also in the middle of time, like, little side note, but I was waiting to hear back about a comic book contest, because, as you know from my columns, I'm a big pop culture geek and writer. And so I was waiting on that. I didn't get into that, but I mean, it was a 3 out of 4 positive thing, so I'll take it. But so I, you know, I heard about it right away because, especially my mom follows a lot of the SMA therapy news, and this was before I started working for BioNews, but, you know, my family and I are pretty deeply involved in the SMA community. We've been going to conferences for a long time. So I found out about the news right away. And it was, of course, really exciting. But I remember, you know, sort of after the initial, you know, celebration and everything, for a while, I was thinking, you know, it kind of went out of my mind for a while, because I knew that it would take some time for it to get approved anyway, because I know how insurance works and it would be a hassle. So, like, my mom started talking with a Biogen representative pretty early on, but it still took months for me to get approved and all that. So it was kind of a thing in the back of my head for a while. Really, the next time I gave it serious thought was a few months later when I got asked to speak at a conference in Maryland that was organized by Cure SMA and the FDA. And that was a bunch of panelists from the SMA community speaking to the FDA about our experiences and the need for treatments and drug therapies and that kind of thing. And it was a, you know, really fantastic conference. I was happy to be a part of it. But that was, again, it forced me to really think about it and about Spinraza and what it would, the kind of impact it would have. And for me, for a while, and I talked to other adults in the SMA community who felt this way too, I had a lot of anxieties about it, because while it was, of course, going, you know, fantastic news, and, you know, just the idea of stopping the progression was huge for me. It was also one of those things where, you know, I had to think about, okay, do I want to really go in regularly for injections that could very well be painful? I don't know. You know, and that how much would this interfere with my personal and work life? Would it be, you know, worth the effort? Would it be would it cause too much fatigue or pain or all these things? So all these things kind of I wrestled with. And so I tried to put it back in my mind for a while. Then I ended up getting approved in July of last year. And again, the anxieties just kind of came back to me. I just wasn't sure how the process would go. And I wasn't sure if it was really going to be worth it or not for me, because, while stopping their progression would be great, you know, I don't know. I wasn't sure if it was going to help me, get back any abilities. And if so, what would that look like? So all these things were kind of going through my mind. But when I did get approved, I started talking with other adults around my age. And again, this is where I'm glad that I had such connections to the SMA community. And you know, I talked with other adults who had gone through it or started the process and asked them what it was like. You know, did they do the spinal injection? Did they have other methods? And, you know, I felt a little bit better after that. But I was still going to be at least somewhat anxious until the first injection, which was, I got approved in July. I didn't start the injections till November of last year. Because, you know, insurance, and it just took longer than we wanted to get the ball rolling. But my Biogen representative was great from the beginning. And I also knew I was comforted by the fact that my neurologist, who I'd known for several years, was going to be overseeing and doing the injection. So that gave me a sense of relief. But, you know, I still had anxieties leading up to it. And then the first injection day came, and they started by taking me into a room to see if they could do the spinal injection first. And so they did a few x-rays, and I kind of doubted that they would be able to do it this way, because I had spinal fusion in 2005, which is a very common procedure for pretty much anyone with SMA. And so I have, you know, metal rods fused into my spine, and that prevented them from being able to safely do the spinal injection. And so that's when they told me that they wanted to try doing a cervical injection, which is a shot in the neck. You know, and that, of course, brought a lot of anxiety as well, especially for my dad, who was there with me on the – he and my mom were both with me on the first injection day. But I said, you know, hey, it's worth a shot. You know, I'm willing to try it. At that point, you know, I had come to terms with all the anxieties, and I was ready to just try whatever they had, see how it went. And for me, that actually – the cervical injections have worked phenomenally well. The way it works is they do a CT scan to figure out exactly where to put the needle. And then they, you know, a few minutes later, they get you set up, put the needle in, and then administer the medicine that way. And for me, that's worked out really well just because it's actually really not painful at all. And really beyond the pain, I was worried about it taking too much energy for me to do each injection. And for me, the cervical injections have not taken a lot of energy out of me. They've been actually pretty smooth. Basically, on injection days, I do the injection. I stay in the hospital for about an hour. And I'm fortunate enough to be 30 minutes away from Duke Hospital, so I don't have to travel or anything like a lot of families do. And I stay in the hospital for about an hour to rest, come home and kind of take it easy the rest of the day. But after that, after each injection, I've been good to go the next day, get back to work. And even after my first injection, I had a Comic-Con to go to that weekend that I was doing panels at, and I was good to go the next day after. So
yeah.
So it's worked out really great for me. And like you said, you know, like seemingly insignificant improvements, but really big ones for me, you know, energy levels, voice, all of that.
Yeah, I think for the able-bodied, the little changes we see would be so insignificant to them, they probably wouldn't notice. But we notice those changes.
And right,
you said something about the anxiety of having to go through the injections. I went through the same thing. And one of the things that I came to realization with, or I tried to come to realization with, was, you know, if I've got a chance to get better at this age, because I'll be 54 in August, at this age, this may be my last chance to try it. So I knew that I was going to go through it no matter what. And I was really surprised after my first injection. They had a little bit of trouble finding a spot because, like you, I've got the two rods in my back. And the doctor that was going to do it told me, I mean, they even took me off the table and put me back in bed. He said, Michael, I don't think I'm going to be able to find an opening. And so he said, but I'm going to call a specialist that's been doing these type of lumbar punctures for, you know, 25, 30 years. So he called the doctor. The doctor came over, looked at the x-rays and looked at the scans. And he said, I think I can find a place. So the doctor came into the room, and it was one of those moments where, you know, when somebody walks in the room and you just know that everything's going to be okay. It was like that. He walked in the room, came up, sat down next to me, put his hand on my shoulder, got eye to eye with me. And he said, look, he said, if you'll allow me to put you back on the table and put you in another uncomfortable position, he said, I think I can do this injection. And so he got me back up on the table, got me almost on my stomach, but more on my side where I was a little bit more comfortable. And they ended up doing the lidocaine in my back. And to be honest with you, that was the only thing I felt. After that, they did the injection. He found a sizable enough opening where he felt safe, you know, in trying it. And they got it right after that. So, again, the anxiety, and I think that's something that a lot of people need to quit worrying about, is when they use lidocaine, you normally do not feel much after that unless they hit a nerve, which they've done on me once. But, and I know some people say that, oh, it's not fun to go through, but me personally, I haven't found it to be bad at all.
No, it really hasn't. I mean, you know, I have heard the horror stories and all that, and, you know, I'm not going to pretend that they don't exist. And that was something that I was nervous about. But for the most part, you know, myself included and everyone I've talked to, they've had pretty smooth processes. And really, the risks are always going to be there, but I would say it's definitely worth it, you know?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think if you're on the fence trying to figure out whether or not you want to have it done, my opinion is go for it. What do you have to lose? You know,
right.
You can always
right.
say stop. You can always say stop. I don't want to do it. But
right. Right.
Why not try it and see what it does to your body? Because with all the success stories that they've had so far, and the success stories are only going to continue, why not be part of that success?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I know we've talked a lot, and this was a great conversation, and we've hit on a lot of topics here, but I know we spent a lot of this episode, and we spend a lot of time just in general on our videos and podcasts, of course, talking about things related to SMA and medical advice, et cetera. But I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking with each other about our daily lives and just our interests beyond, you know, obviously you're a passionate advocate for the SMA community and for research, but I wanted to know a little bit about more about kind of your daily life outside of work, and then, you know, what kind of were your big interests now and growing up. If you can just talk about that for a little bit, that'd be great.
Sure. No, I definitely have interest outside of SMA. I know that whenever I was growing up, I was an avid fisherman. I loved to fish. My father and my grandfather and I went fishing all the time. I took speech therapy as a child. And so every Thursday, my grandfather would drive me to Southern Methodist University, SMU, here in Dallas. And I took speech therapy. And so he would always hook up his bass boat to the back of his truck. So after speech therapy, we'd always go out fishing. So I was an avid fisherman. When all of my friends were getting cars for graduation from high school, I got a boat. My parents bought a pontoon barge, and we put it out on a lake out in Henderson County. It was a lake called Cedar Creek Lake. So while most kids got cars, I got a boat. And we spent a lot of time fishing. And, you know, that I was a little bit stronger back then as well. But I noticed it was probably around that time that I started getting a little bit weaker, because it was a little bit more hard, a little bit harder to cast, a little bit harder to do some of the things that I normally didn't have any trouble doing at all. So, you know, I got other interests. I started getting into computers. That's what I majored in college. And started out as an accounting major. It took principles of accounting 4 times before I finally got through it. And the accounting instructor pulled me aside. He said, "Michael, you're a great guy. You got a great spirit, but you need to find another career other than trying to be a CPA. So I knew at that time, I better find something else. So my grandmother actually told me, she said, "Baby, you need to get into computers." So that's what I did. So
what was it, computer science or?
No, I looked into computer science, but good night. You know, goodness gracious. That is way, way too much math for me. So I ended up going the MIS, the Management Information Systems route.
Gotcha.
And so I did that and graduated in 91 from the University of Texas at Dallas with a Bachelor's of Science with a concentration in MIS. And then finished graduate school with a MBA in management. And then I had a wonderful opportunity. I was at one of the local junior colleges that I attended, and one of the professors asked me if I'd like to fill in for a lady that was going on maternity leave. So I got to teach her class, and she ended up retiring. So they ended up offering me her job on a permanent basis. So I taught college at night, and I did that for 18 years.
And that was on top of your day job, right?
Yes. I worked, I would leave the house at 4:30 in the morning, go to work. I would work from 6 to 3, come home, take off the shirt and tie, put on a polo shirt, go and teach from 5:30 to 10:30.
That's impressive. I mean, I'm a workaholic, I consider myself, but that's a new level. Like, what was that like in terms of energy level and all that? Like, did you feel really fatigued, or was it manageable?
No, it was completely manageable. I'm not to say I wasn't tired, but sure. I know that, you know, while I was getting my master's, they actually allowed me to teach, even though I was still working on my master's. So as long as I continued working on my master's, I could teach, because you really needed a master's to teach at that time. So I was teaching on Tuesday, Thursdays, and then on Monday and Wednesday nights, I would go to school. So I would leave the house in the morning when it was dark, and I would come home when it was dark. The only time I saw daylight was when I left work in the afternoon to come home and drive over to the college, and that was it. So I only saw daylight for a very small amount during the weeks.
Wow, that's commitment, but I bet the pay was nice, though, with both of those.
I wasn't arguing with the pay.
Yeah.
Wasn't arguing at all with that, but sometimes sanity, you got to slow down every once in a while.
Yeah, I agree. Oh, I mean, it's something I encounter too. I mean, I push myself hard, and I think that's a trait for a lot of people with SMA and disabilities in general, is that, you know, we really do push ourselves harder than most because we're just used to more challenges than most people, you know? And so I think it's a common trait, but I find myself in that way as well. And sometimes I just need to, nope, I'm not going to do a ton of work today. Just take it easy. And that's really necessary for our mental health as well as our physical.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. All right, cool. Well, that's really cool getting to know kind of, yeah, a little more about your background, because I knew some of it, but, and that's really cool about fishing and everything. I guess I can share then some of my background, which if you follow my column, you can get to know me really well on a personal level. I was born and raised in Cary, North Carolina, and I still live with my parents today. And I have a caregiver who I've had for about 4 years, who's great. He comes with me he's every day throughout the week. And then I'm the youngest of three. My brother and I are 2.5 years apart. And my sister and I are 5 years apart. She's married and has a kid. But as you can gather from all my columns, I'm a huge pop culture nut. And I majored in English with a film studies concentration in college and a creative writing minor. And it's always funny that I ended up with the job that I have now, because while it does fit me perfectly, I never really planned on doing something like this, working for a site that was focused on SMA, because people always expected me to, you know, be a movie blogger or something in that field. And, you know, it would have made sense, because when I was in college, I worked for the school newspaper as the features editor, and I was really into overseeing the arts and entertainment section and writing movie reviews and interviewing filmmakers and comedians and artists and whatnot. But I remember the first times I really started writing about disability and about my perspective, I started just doing some columns on the side for the paper about that subject. I mean, I think one of the first one I had written about was about disability portrayal in mainstream media and in movies, and how often it's really poorly done. And I did columns about that, and I remember those got just more attention than anything else I had written, even, you know, a lot of my pop culture stuff. And I found that I really liked, you know, writing about it. And so I did more columns like that throughout my time at the Technician at NC State. And then when I got out of college, you know, I was trying to decide what I wanted to do. I mean, I knew I wanted to write, obviously, but I wasn't sure, you know, how I would go about getting a full-time job and all these things. And so I freelanced for a little while and just kind of sent, I had some contacts I knew who helped me get set up freelance writing for their websites or their nonprofits or whatever. And I did that. And, you know, and I did get an article published in Quest magazine a few months out of college, the MBA Quest magazine. But I was still looking for, you know, something more steady. And I came across SMA News Today one day when I was just Googling SMA writers and see if I could find something. And I came across the site and Bio News and learned about what they did. And so I started just writing the column for SMA News Today And actually, at that conference I mentioned earlier on in our conversation that was held in Maryland, the FDA QRSMA conference, that's when I actually met our bosses, Mike and Chris, who are the heads of BioNews Services. They were at that conference. I got to meet them in person there. And that was actually the first day that my first column got published. And so I did the column for a while, which I still do. And then they hired me full time about a little over a year ago. And so that's what I've been doing ever since then. And it's kind of cool how all my interests have intersected, because really the reason I got the full-time job was and how I created this podcast. Yeah, this is for our listeners out there. If you've been listening for a podcast for a while, you're getting a really behind the scenes look at how it at its origins here. The way I remember, it was around that time I got the idea to do a podcast for the website and about where I would interview people in the SMA community. And I had already been podcasting for a while, because I do a pop culture entertainment one with some friends, and where we review movies and comic books and all that. And I sent a link to one of those episodes in which we interviewed a comic book creator to Mike, and I pitched him the idea of the podcast. And that's when he was like, yes, that sounds like a great idea, you know? And that's when they hired me full time, because I had so many connections to the SMA community. So it's really cool how it's all intersected. You know, I mean, I never expected to be where I am now, but I love it, you know, and I love being able to connect with people out there with SMA, talk about my life and all that. But yeah, and of course I get to still write, you know, about all my interests in my column, which I really love. So it's really cool to see how it's all played out. And that's really my best advice to the people that's out there, is just, you know, it's a cheesy saying of, you know, stay hopeful and everything, keep your head up, but it's very true. You know, I mean, if you find what you're passionate about and you're willing to work hard toward it, and you're willing to work around obstacles that SMA may present, you know, I can guarantee you it's worth it. And, you know, so it's a great life, and it's only getting better with, you know, the news out there of research and all these things going on. So, yeah. So it's really cool. But yeah.
Yeah. I know I had the pleasure of meeting Chris. He was in Dallas, and so he stopped by my house and we had lunch and we were talking, and he said, how do you like working for BioNews? I said, I don't really consider it work. I said, to me, it's something that I truly enjoy doing. So if you enjoy what you're doing, if you enjoy what you do, you really don't work a day in your life. And so, you know, I've always taken any employment opportunity that, if I don't enjoy doing what I'm doing, I'm not going to do it.
Right.
You know,
right.
I don't care if the money's great or not. If I dread going to work all the time, then I'm wasting my time. And I used to ask that question to my students. I would say, if you got the chance to work for a company and get paid really, really good money, but they treat you like garbage, or you could make a little bit less and work for a company where they treat you like a person, which one would you take? And most of my students wanted the money. And I told them, I said, yeah, you'll learn when you're out there in the industry that you'll take that job where they treat you better, much faster. And, you know, BioNews has been a blessing for me, because it's allowed me to work from home. It's allowed me to make a little bit more money, which definitely helps. I'm not going to lie about that. But it's just a job where I really enjoy, you know, doing it 8 hours a day. And sometimes I'm, you know, on the weekends, we're always online. So I think the SMA forum and the other forums that we run here at BioNews, it really serves a purpose.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just the idea that, I mean, that's the thing, is part of the reason I felt kind of, you know, not wanting to engage in the SMA community when I was younger is because this is something that's changed a lot, but when I was younger, a lot of time the conferences were, you know, they had stuff for kids, and then they had, you know, information about research, and those are great. But for me, I didn't see as much, you know, going on with the adult side of things and the young adults. And it's changed a lot since then. There is now a really thriving SMA community, both online and in person at those conferences, and in, I'm sure, in other areas as well. But that was for me what I was looking for. I wanted to be able to learn from people who are older for me than me in the SMA community to hear their experiences. And so that's my hope that with my column each week, with the forums, the podcast, all these things that, you know, it's making someone else's life with SMA a little easier because we can kind of share experiences together and, you know, answer questions and just show people that, you know, life with SMA is not by definition miserable by any means. And that's not to say, and I don't mean to say that insensitively because I know SMA has, you know, been heartbreaking for countless families out there who have lost people because of it. And, you know, my heart goes out to them, of course. But what I'm saying is that, you know, just because we have, those of us who are living have SMA doesn't mean we have to be, live miserable, you know, closed off lives. And my advice out there to not only to people with SMA, but to parents out there is as nerve-wracking as it can be to let your kids with SMA kind of spread their wings and, you know, do things that may be risky, you know, like, I mean, going out with friends late or, you know, letting friends drive them, which are both the things that my parents have done for me. And I'm really grateful for that. I would just really encourage you to take that step. And this is something I say in my column a lot because, you know, for me, one of the things I'm most grateful for is that my parents always let me live my life. You know, they let me go to school, let me go to college. And, you know, friends drive me around and it's just a really liberating thing because yes, we are going to have limitations and I know when I can't do something or it's going to be too risky and I don't, you know, and I think you, for parents out there, it's important to just trust your kid's judgment on matters like that. To not be too, I get the need to be nurturing and protective, but also to not be too overprotective that, you know, your kid, to prevent your kids from living their lives, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, I think I saw that at the conference in June here in Dallas was these parents were letting their kids be kids. They were allowing them to experience the joy of just being a child. You know, they weren't a child with a ventilator. They were a child. And my parents, like yours, allowed me to be a child. You know, they never let me use my wheelchair as an excuse. I still had to do good in school. I still got in trouble just like every other kid. You know, I did stupid things that I wasn't supposed to do. But my parents allowed me to do that because it was all part of the growing up process. And you see a lot of parents shelter their children and they won't allow them to make mistakes. And some of my biggest accomplishments were learned by failure. You know, some of my biggest, I guess, I was allowed to make mistakes. And I think by being allowed to make mistakes, I learned more that way because I learned what not to do.
Absolutely. No, I 100% agree. And, you know, I mean, I just want to say I applaud any parent with SMA out there. I know it's, you know, being a parent is hard enough. Being a parent with SMA is 10 times that at least, if not more. And so, you know, every SMA parent out there is just, in my mind, a superhuman. And so I say those things not in a critical way, but just to say that that's one of the things I'm most grateful for is how my parents treated me. They treated me the same as my siblings, and they really let me, you know, just spread my wings. And I wouldn't be as independent as I am today if it weren't for the way they treated me and the way that they pushed me to, you know, be the best, you know, student and employee that I could be, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, don't shelter your kids where everything is perfect. You know, life is imperfect. That's just part of life. And I think parents are seeing this, especially with SMA children, because now there's a lot more hope that they can cling on to, you know, as far as knowing that, you know, yeah, their child may have SMA, but with Spinraza, with these other treatments that are going to be coming around the corner someday, there's just so much more hope that, you know, your child that was supposed to only live till their 20s may live a full life now.
Right. No, it's just huge. Just the things that have come about just in my own lifetime, you know, are incredible. Research-wise, information-wise, community support, all these things. It's just night and day, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely so.
Absolutely.
Definitely so.
Well, this was a heck of a conversation. To our listeners out there, I really thank you for sticking through this. And Michael, of course, thank you for taking time out of your work schedule, and also mine. So it's the advantages we get to be doing this for work. So it worked.
That's right.
But, no, I just really thank you for sharing your story, talking with me. This was a really great conversation, and we're glad to have you at BioNews, of course.
Well, thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it. I greatly appreciate you taking the time out of your day to do this podcast along with me. All right?
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
All right, sir.
And, you know, for more episodes out there to our listeners, you can subscribe today to the SMA News Today podcast. We're all over Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, and you can download episodes right here on our website at www.smanewstoday.com. As I said, I am community editor, so I oversee a lot of the social content here on SMA News Today. Michael is our forums director, and you can also check out his YouTube channel, which he does for the site called the Morale Monologue. And you can check out that. You can check out our other podcasts. You can check out the forums. And so we just want to thank you again for joining us here today. And be sure to follow SMA News Today for daily digital coverage of spinal muscular atrophy. I'm Kevin Schaefer. We will see you next time.
And I'm Michael Morale. Have a great day, guys.